From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today, we're bringing you a program which sparked quite a response when it first aired last summer. Sitting in front of a glowing laptop in her small apartment, Elle Snow is typing up an online ad.
You put in your title. You could be simple. You would put, like, your height, your weight.
Elle's posting an ad on Backpage.com, the classified website used by millions to sell everything from antiques to used bikes. But her ad is in the escort section, where people go to buy and sell sex. A heads up to listeners, today we'll be talking a lot about sexual exploitation and the inner workings of the sex trade.
It's the most profitable way to work is through these ads. On the street, you get paid a lot less, plus it's a lot more dangerous.
Elle isn't really offering herself up for sex. What she's doing is trying to catch pimps and traffickers. She knows a lot about the sex trade because she was trafficked herself. That's why we're not using her real name. She was dating a guy who turned out to be a pimp. Elle says he lured her to Sacramento, supposedly for a vacation. Then he used threats and violence to force her into having sex with as many as 10 men a day.
I was there for, now I believe it's like 7 months. 7 months of pure shock. That does a lot of stuff to your brain, you know. That's really, really hard to come back from.
Elle escaped. As for the pimp, she eventually helped send him to prison for raping and trafficking a 16-year-old girl. This was 2 years ago, and it was the first and only successful sex trafficking case in this part of California. Elle doesn't live in a big city. Her hometown, Eureka, is perched in a remote corner of the state's rugged North Coast. These days, she runs a small nonprofit called Game Over. Elle sees it as her obligation, her duty to disrupt the sex trade, which is thriving even in rural communities like hers. She keeps as many as 5 different cell phones by her side. There's her real phone for friends and family. Then there are the cheap burner phones. She uses them to take calls and texts from people answering her fake sex ads, like this one from a guy in Georgia.
His initial text was, "Hey, gorgeous, how are you?" This is a trafficker, by the way. "Look, I don't know your situation. I just know I'm interested. If you're happy, I can respect that. But if not, and you're unhappy, and lately you've been thinking about choosing or changing your situation, give me a call or text. Let's talk about it."
Elle can't prove that all of these men are involved with trafficking, a much more serious crime than prostitution, and involves children and adults forced into the sex trade. But after just a few months, she collects nearly 500 names and phone numbers of potential sex buyers and passes them on to police, who are starting to pay attention. Recently, she brought along one of her burner phones for a training session with police cadets at the College of the Redwoods in Eureka.
So this is a $25 phone from Target. We all know what it is. Usually used for drug dealers, disposable phones, right? So I posted the first ad for this profile today. I've already gotten 15 different callers on this phone. So I have it set on vibrate. And here it goes again. New message right now.
Elle cuts a striking figure in a sea of blue uniforms. She's 6 feet tall with long blonde hair. 2 large tattoos are stamped on her arms. One is a saint, the other a demon. Throughout our talk with cadets, you can hear the phones buzzing with new calls and texts pouring in.
This is from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. 1 in 5 runaways in 2015 were likely sex trafficking victims.
When the session ends 3 hours later, Elle finds that more than 24 people have responded to her ad on Backpage.
This is not just metropolitan areas. It's absolutely in rural communities. I've seen it. I've witnessed it.
Powered by the internet, the sex trade is reaching into all corners of the U.S. But there's another reason it's thriving in this part of Northern California: marijuana. Fishing, ranching, and timber were once big industries here. But now it's pot. The pot trade is worth billions, and police say that in recent years, it's become intermingled with the sex trade and organized crime.
We wouldn't really have the gangs here. We wouldn't have the Mexican mafia. We wouldn't have, you know, the Russian mafia here if we didn't have the pot industry.
This region is known as the Emerald Triangle. Up here, the trade is dominated by men, and it's a secretive world. That's because pot has occupied a legal gray zone in California. Medical marijuana has been legal, but recreational was only legalized last fall. Still, the trade has been booming for a while and attracting seasonal workers from around the globe. Most show up around the big fall harvest. A lot of the work involves trimming, harvesting marijuana plants, and carefully manicuring their flowers or buds with small scissors. We made this recording with two women who were trimming on a pot farm set deep in the mountains of Humboldt County. They're hoping to make enough money to grow their own weed.
But I like to come in and, like, get them at their little roots.
The boom is also attracting traffickers and sexual predators. And because growing and selling marijuana has been semi-legal, a lot of that violence is never reported.
I mean, none of this is monitored. I mean, no one's going to know, like, that you're here or not here. I mean, it's easy to go missing, I guess. It's easy for bad people to take advantage of it.
And that's what this hour's about. We're going to look at the hidden places, real and virtual, where people are exploited for sex. Our partner for today's show is APM Reports, the investigative and documentary unit of American Public Media. We begin deep in California's pot country with Reveal's Shoshana Walter. She spent months there investigating sexual violence and found that as the pot trade gets bigger, the problems are getting worse. Here's Sho.
This is a place that's used to keeping secrets. For decades, the forests have provided cover for the pot trade. But I found something else hidden in these stunning redwoods and remote valleys. Stories of sexual abuse and exploitation. I'll start with a young woman named Carmen who lived in a small town in central Mexico with her family. We don't identify victims of sexual violence, so we're not using Carmen's real name or the names of other victims in the story. Her mother had cancer and her father was unemployed. They were struggling. Then 2 years ago, Carmen says she and her sister met a man named Baldomar Alvarez on Facebook. He said he had large properties in Northern California and offered them a bright future.
He told my sister and me, girls, when you get here, you're going to be very comfortable. You're going to have a job. I talked to some friends who own restaurants, and they're going to give you a job. You two only need to worry about crossing the border, and your life will change.
Your life will change. It's the promise so many undocumented immigrants hope to hear. It's also a common ploy used by traffickers. Carmen left her family in Mexico, and a smuggler brought her across the border into the United States. But there was no restaurant job waiting for her. Instead, Baldomar took her to an isolated house about 150 miles north of San Francisco. He put her to work on a cluster of pot farms. Carmen suspected they were illegal.
All the time I was in fear. If the police catch me, they're going to arrest me. They're not going to let me explain. They're not going to believe me.
When Carmen wasn't working, she lived with Baldomar and his two sons. She says he ordered her to cook and clean the house. She says he also forced her to have sex with him, to repay him for the $12,000 he spent smuggling her into the country.
Did he give you any idea of how long you would owe him?
Yes, he said that I should be with him, through appreciation and payment of everything he did for me, for at least 2 years. And still, I wouldn't finish paying him.
Carmen told me she didn't know anyone. She didn't speak much English and felt isolated and trapped. In August of 2014, after nearly 5 months of abuse, Carmen asked Baldomar to take her to a clinic for stomach pains. A nurse examined her and gave her some disturbing news.
They told her she was 7 weeks and 6 days pregnant.
That's Teresa Borjun. She works with victims of sexual abuse in Mendocino County. She says Carmen told the nurse that Baldomar was keeping her against her will and forcing her to have sex with him almost every day.
She was really upset. She was in tears and didn't know where to go. She didn't know nobody in this county.
A few days later, sheriff's deputies showed up at his house. They brought in Baldomar and Carmen for questioning. But from the beginning, they seemed to doubt Carmen's story. She told me one detective suggested she was making it up to get immigration documents. When the questioning was over, Carmen says this is what the detectives told her.
Unfortunately, at this time, we do not have any evidence to detain him. Everything you say, he denies.
Deputies did arrest Baldomar Alvarez for illegal marijuana cultivation, but he was out of jail in 20 minutes and never prosecuted. The Mendocino County Sheriff's Office declined to discuss the case. I went to Baldomar's home a few times to talk with him, but no one was ever there. Finally, just before finishing the story, I reached him on his cell phone. He told me Carmen's story was a lie.
That I thought she was my wife. You know, we're supposed to get married and we're planning to make a family. That was her and my agreement.
He admitted that he paid someone to sneak Carmen across the border. He said Carmen still owed him for that. And he insisted he was trying to help her earn money for her family back in Mexico. But I tracked down other women who knew Baldomar, including the mother of one of his children. She told me Baldomar had abused her, too, after bringing her into the U.S. from Mexico. And she said there were other women.
Whatever this person is, she's lying, too. I mean, I swear it's not the case. I never abused her or anything. You know, everything, you help someone and all you get is a stab in the back. You know what I mean?
As for Carmen, with Teresa's help, she boarded a Greyhound bus and fled to safety in another state. This story is one of dozens I uncovered in the Emerald Triangle. Undocumented immigrants like Carmen told me they had no idea they'd end up trapped on pot farms in Northern California and abused. Other women I spoke to came here specifically to work in the pot trade, earning money harvesting and trimming marijuana plants. They're called trimmigrants, and thousands pour into the Emerald Triangle for the fall harvest season. College students and artists, working professionals, hippies, and other wanderers from around the globe. Many had positive stories and worked here without any big hassles. But other trimmigrants had bad experiences. They were robbed or beat up or raped. But unlike Carmen, they never went to the police. Then I spotted a rare case that actually made it through the criminal justice system. A 21-year-old environmentalist we're calling Terry moved here from Southern California to work on a pot farm. She ended up in the small remote town of Petrolia in Humboldt County. Jen Breyer Bonpain was a trauma counselor there and says something terrible happened to Terry.
I was really saddened, disgusted, scared. Scared for the women in the community, scared for her, scared for myself a little bit.
Terry didn't want to talk on tape, but she agreed to let Jen tell her story. It starts with a grower offering her a job, then a lift home late one night in his pickup truck.
He went the wrong way in the truck, pulled up to the gate of this very dark, heavily forested eucalyptus grove, and stopped the truck and started touching her and said, "You're my bitch. If you do anything with anyone else, I'll kill you." And she said something like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I'll freeze your body and break you into pieces and feed you to the animals."
Terry said he raped her in a nearby trailer. The man's name is Kalen Meserve. He's a local guy, captain on the volunteer fire department, and the son of a prominent environmental activist who moved here in the 1960s. Rumors about what happened that night quietly spread around town. Some people doubted Terry and were quick to defend Kalen. He grew up here. She's an outsider.
The initial reaction of even some of my friends were, "Well, what really happened? Or was she asking for it? Or who even really was she?"
Sam Epperson runs a small organic farm in Petrolia. Terry worked here, trimming buds in a small shed.
We're standing in the middle of the garden. You can see at the base of each plant, there's a drip system here with an emitter.
Sam grows a mix of fruits, vegetables, and marijuana on about 2 acres. When I visited Sam's farm earlier last summer, his pot plants were 5 feet tall, bright green and leafy.
When I was a kid, you wouldn't have plants growing in the full sun like this because someone would come and take them away.
Where would you be growing them?
In the partial shade in the forest.
Sam was raised in a hippie family that grew marijuana to get by, not to get rich. Back then, running even a small pot farm could land you in prison, so growers and their children lived like semi-outlaws.
I was taught never to talk about it on the phone. You don't talk about the industry because you never know when someone will try to harm you. What we learned, maybe, my generation learned, was how to tell a lie.
Terry's assault posed a dilemma for a lot of people in town, including Sam. He had vouched for Kalen and encouraged Terry to consider working for him. On the other hand, Kalen was known for his hot temper, Many people believed he was buying up land for large-scale pot grows, and they were bothered by that, too. But Jen Breyer-Ponpain, Terry's trauma counselor, says people were reluctant to call in the cops.
I think of Petrolia as this little town kind of hanging off the edge of the world, and it's very remote. Often there's a sense of, like, not wanting to involve law enforcement because it impinges on people's rights. People might get in trouble for stuff related to pot. So, yeah, and then there's also this, like, caretaking part, which is the more positive part of that, I think, of, like, restorative justice. Like, we don't want to just throw people to the wolves.
Simply put, many of Petrolia's residents don't trust law enforcement. That's common across the Emerald Triangle, even when someone witnesses or experiences serious violence. They feel the cops won't understand, or they'll be treated as snitches by the pot-growing community, or they might face some other kind of retaliation, even violence.
There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of, you know, if you report this, nobody will believe you.
Brenda Bishop directs Humboldt Domestic Violence Services. I meet her at one of the shelters they run, a house on a quiet tree-lined street in Eureka.
So we're at the Safe Haven. It's a confidential location, and that's about as much information I can give you.
More than a dozen women and their children live here in rooms stacked with bunk beds. In 2015, Brenda's group took in around 2,000 crisis calls, an increase of more than 80% over the past 4 years. Brenda says much of this is due to a surge in sexual abuse and trafficking on pot grows.
People just don't call and say, I'm being sex trafficked. It was a matter of kind of doing the intake and listening to what was going on. But the more we were seeing trimmers coming into the community for work, the more we were seeing women who were being sex trafficked. We also started seeing women who were being brought up specifically for trimming and for sex trafficking to provide sex for the kind of overlords or people who were seeing overseeing the grows, the larger grows.
A big marijuana grow can have 1,000 plants or more. And quite often, this pot isn't sold in California's legal marketplace. It's shipped illegally to other states for big profits. That's one reason the cops tend to look at anyone involved in this as common criminals.
We were a community that was very tolerant, and very tolerant based on the medicinal properties of marijuana. And I think what happened is there became this outside influence. This is a great place to grow pot. And that tolerance level was really pushed. And I think it was pushed to the extreme that the police here, the law enforcement, really were taken by surprise.
It's tough.
Andy Mills is the chief of police in Eureka. He agrees that sexual violence on pot grows is getting worse. And he says prosecutions are rare because they don't have enough evidence. And a small force spends a lot of its time trying to catch big-time drug dealers. But he says trimmers need to realize they're placing themselves in danger.
That's obviously not to say that that woman or that young man deserves to be sexually assaulted. They absolutely do not. But I think we can all do things to minimize our risk, and not going to one of these grows is a good way to minimize your risk.
Instead of developing more criminal cases, Chief Mills is trying to discourage trimmigrants from coming here in the first place. It's a sort of reverse sting. His department posts fake ads on Craigslist offering work on pot farms.
Message 3.
Hi, this is Shai. I just went on Craigslist.
This is one of hundreds of job seekers who have responded to the ads with calls and emails.
That's when I saw an ad of needing help with clippings.
But there are no jobs. What the applicants get is a stern warning from Chief Mills that goes something like this.
You didn't contact a grower, you contacted the police. We have a very high incident of violence in our county. And some people come up to grow and don't go back.
In Petrolia, people got together at each other's homes, debating what to do about Terry's attacker, Kayla Meserve. Most of the ideas didn't involve bringing in the police. Suggestions included form a community tribunal, have the elderly women chase after him with their shoes, send a large group of men to his house to talk some sense into him. As for Terry, her therapist, Jen, says she was still in shock.
She just wanted to disappear and never speak of it.
Then the town found out about another woman who had accused Kaylin of assaulting her the year before. Kaylin's boss at the firehouse even knew about it, but didn't call the police. All he did was make Kaylin promise to do better. That was it.
there was just a lot of fear, like, if this is just going to keep happening, if we don't have something on record to kind of hold him accountable, whatever form that takes or however far it goes.
Residents finally decided to call the police. Terry agreed, but almost immediately, the process seemed to confirm their fears about the cops. Terry was asked to come to the sheriff's office to give a formal statement. It's a 2-hour drive along a winding, crumbling road. The deputy who met her was brusque and refused to allow Jen to accompany Terry into the small interview room. After the brief meeting, the deputy said the sheriff's office had talked to Kaylin and would not be taking any action. No charges, no restraining order.
I think she felt even more kind of shamed and also just given the runaround. She made this big trip into town. She had to really work up the courage to do it. Again, she was doing it because community members wanted her to put it on record in case something happened in the future. And then she was treated like that.
Over several months, a group of Petrolia residents flooded the district attorney's office with emails and phone calls. The earlier victim came forward. There was a new DA, a woman with experience handling sex crimes. Prosecutors renewed the investigation and charged Kaylin with raping Terry and the other woman. He was convicted, and last summer he was sentenced to 23 years. It was the first prosecution of its kind in Humboldt County, and a big deal for the people in Petrolia. Still, when I went to see Sam Epperson, he was despondent. He's the guy who originally hired Terry to work on his farm.
Are you all right?
I've been having a hard time. The situation seems kind of hopeless.
Sam testified against Kaylin Meserve. He wanted to make sure nothing like this would happen again. But like a lot of people here, Sam still feels conflicted. He wonders if it was a mistake to bring in the police. He can't accept that Kaylin will grow old in prison. He'd rather see him rehabilitated, given a second chance.
My advice would have been to him, but he never came and talked to me, would have been to immediately go into drug rehab, go see a sex therapist that deals with specifically with those kinds of crimes, and to apologize to the community.
Sam remains on his farm. He says he wants to keep things small, modest, and defend the community values embodied by the hippies who settled here almost half a century ago. Jen, Terry's therapist, says the assault and the town's response was another nudge out of Petrolia. She and her family have relocated. Terry, like many Trimmigrants, moved away. Carmen also moved on. She's the woman who says she was trafficked to Northern California from her hometown in Mexico. She started working as a cook at a Mexican restaurant in another state and moved into a small two-bedroom apartment with her father, aunt, uncle, nephew, and her 1-year-old daughter.
After this story aired last summer, the community in Northern California took action. An association of major marijuana growers called for better labor regulations and called for an end to the silence about sexual abuse in the pot grows. One of the country's largest labor unions even got involved. The deputy who investigated Kaylin Meserve was reassigned, and the Humboldt County undersheriff acknowledged their investigation could have been handled better. That said, even though California has fully legalized marijuana, the state has yet to develop new regulations that might protect workers. Next, we hear from a man who made a career out of luring women into the sex trade and who's not shy about sharing his secrets. Coming up on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.